Welcome to Career Tools. This week, I'm Not a People Person, Chapter 2. The questions this cast answers are, how do I become a people person? What do people do differently? And can I fake being a people person?
Hey, are you in the Silicon Valley area and have been wanting to attend a manager tools conference with really small class sizes? If so, you've got less than a week to sign up for our next Manager Tools public conference, slated for June 16th and 17th in Cupertino. Mark will be the presenter with our group of no more than 9 attendees, all wonderfully socially distanced. Register online today at manager-tools.com/training. There are only 2 seats left, so you're going to want to hurry.
In the first chapter of this series, we talked about some simple behavioral changes that you can make in order to appear more of a people person. So there are people, like people who like interacting with other people, who like to have other people around, who feel energized by being able to have a discussion or by being able to bounce their ideas off other people. And there are not people, people who don't find any of those things energizing, who would prefer to do their work alone and then, you know, present it to someone and then have a discussion about it. People who go to long meetings and feel drained afterwards. And there's nothing really wrong with either set of people. There's nothing wrong with being a people person. There's nothing wrong with being a not people person. It's just how you are. And that's okay. What you can do differently, though, is you can change your behavior. So you can change the things you do that other people see. And the advantage of people is people like working with them. Because if you go into a meeting and you're a people person, then you tend to energetically and excitedly greet everybody. You make it seem like this is a place you want to be. You remember things about those people. You ask them, hey, I remember you were going on vacation. How was your vacation? And all of those things make people like you more. And if people like you more, they'll work with you more. They'll say nice things about you and you'll get on better at work. So there's a lot of advantages to being that person. There's some disadvantages too, but you know. So if you're not a people person, some of the time you need to exhibit those behaviors so that you get those benefits. And we're not talking about being fake. We're not talking about faking who you are. What we're talking about is some simple changes, some simple behavioral things you can do, which other people will interpret as you being a people person. You know, neither Sarah or I are people.
Perfect that we're recording this cast together.
Exactly. So if you're thinking I'm not a people person, then that's fine. So are we. And
welcome
and
to the world. We've
done pretty well in the world.
Yes.
And often people say to me, they can't tell that I'm not a people person. Sometimes when I was an interviewer, people would say, I couldn't tell whether you liked me or not because you were being so nice. Or you were smiling at me, and so I figured I was doing okay, but, you know, it was hard to tell. So both Sarah and I know the advantages of these behaviors, and there's nothing disingenuous in trying to get on with other people better. It's no different than when you write an email, you try and use the words that will get your point across. You don't use words like, you're an idiot.
Right. You might be thinking it, but you don't say it.
That's it. You use words like, I understand the point you made, and I think there's a couple of factors you missed, right?
Right.
That would change the outcome. You use nice words. And this is part of getting on in the world. And if you have a job where you don't ever talk to people, I want to know what that job is.
Right.
Because I've never heard of one. Even lighthouse keepers have to talk to people occasionally. So we're just encouraging you to do things that will help you get on with people that will reduce the friction of working with other people in your organization. And there is nothing difficult here. There really isn't. We are not saying change your entire personality.
Change everything about who you are.
Yeah. Like change your name and run off to the country. It's my brother once said, there's nothing difficult here. You can do all of these things. And Sarah and I know, because we've done all these things when it's necessary. And you also don't need to do this stuff all of the time. You know, in a meeting, act differently. Do the things that make the meeting go well. And then when you get back to your desk, if your head's down coding and you would rather not be disturbed, then fine, have a sign up that says, you know, please don't disturb me unless it's urgent because I'm doing something I need to concentrate on. So you don't need to do this all the time. You can pick and choose. We'd probably say you need to do it way more than you think.
Way more than you already do, and way more than right. you think you do. Exactly.
Yeah. But we completely believe in you and that you can do these things and reap the benefits.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
So now I've just said all of that. Sarah, give us our outline.
First, we're going to talk about some behavioral remedies, then smiling, saying the phrase, can I help? Taking notes about people's lives and using your smarts differently. Before we start, as before, we just want to make clear that this guidance is not about changing your mindset. Wendy's already said, this is not about changing who you are. Also, this is not therapy, right? This is not a therapy session. We're not trying to give over 2 million people in the form of a podcast a very impersonal format, a way of changing who they are and curing or healing all those childhood ills. Okay? Instead, we're not talking about who you are. Who you are is irrelevant. Rather, this is what you do. And what you do, your behaviors, can be changed.
And therapy might help you. I've been to therapy.
Absolutely.
And I can say it did me a lot of good.
For sure.
But that's not what we're trying
to do.
That's
just not what we're doing.
You know, make a decision about whether or not you think it will be helpful outside of this, but that's not what this is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Why you make these changes is, to some extent, irrelevant. That is, it doesn't matter if the reason you are going about trying to change these behaviors is because you've been told by your boss you'll never be promoted with an attitude like that. It doesn't matter if the reason that you want to change and you want to be more effective and get better at these types of behaviors, that is, be seen as a people person, is because you're on a performance improvement plan, because you cannot work well with others. It doesn't matter why you're making these behavioral changes. The why, like in feedback, doesn't matter in this case. We're all capable of these small behavioral changes to make us better and more effective in our organizations.
So the first one is smiling. And there's some people who've just gone, oh God, I hate those people that smile all the time. They smile inanely at everything. And it's, oh God, I'm just not a smiley person. Well, that's true. You probably aren't a smiley person. You probably have one of those resting faces that we're not going to mention that word. But that doesn't mean you can't do it.
Right.
Smiling is a sign that you are going to work well with somebody else. It serves as a signal that you're joining forces and you are going to do your part to make this thing that you're going to do together work well.
Yes. That's how the human brain thinks of it. That is, half of the world, when meeting a new individual whom they've never met, meeting them for the first time, smiles. The other half of the world, when meeting somebody new for the very first time, does not. It seems to be one of those built-in human responses that naturally comes to us. However, we all know how to smile, regardless of whether or not we're the natural smiler. We know how to do it. And we all also, whether or not we're a natural smiler ourselves, we all respond to smiles. Smiling is a reflex. That is, there's a certain stage in a baby's development. When it's smiled at, it smiles back. We can all do it. It's built into, it's hardwired. It's part of what makes us a human.
And they say that blind people who've never ever seen anyone smile, and they smile when other people smile at them, because you can hear a smile in someone's voice. The other thing I saw was that if you look at blind people on a podium when they've done a race or something and they get medals, they have the same expressions as sighted people.
Yeah, so I believe that.
The expression part of our brain is not predicated on seeing other, being able to physically see other people. It's predicated on the emotions or something else. I don't know what. That's a bit scientific. When scientists look at it, we smile more when we're around other people. So both Sarah and I work from home. We tend not to smile when we're sending email because there's nobody around, right?
There's no one there.
But if we were working in an office, we would smile at the people who walk past, or, you know, if somebody stands up, we'd look at them and smile. It's just something we do when there's other people around us. And it's not being fake if you have to remind yourself to smile. It's a common human reaction to see other people. And according to scientists, it sends the message that you are willing to cooperate with someone to achieve something together. And we know this because when study participants are offered the choice to work with someone who is smiling, they used photos, I think, of these, or a lineup. And like, some people were smiling and some people weren't. And the study participants always choose the person who smiled at them to work with rather than the person who didn't. And if you just think about it, if you just picture in your head someone smiling and someone not smiling, which person would you rather go into another room and build a Lego thing with? It would be the person who's smiling.
Yeah.
So if you want people to want to work with you, which you do if you want to get ahead, then smile.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Now, human beings do have the ability to tell the difference between real. Well, how do you pronounce that word, Wendy? Duchenne?
I pronounce it Duchenne. But
Duchenne?
I don't know.
Yeah, Duchenne smiles? That's a
We should spell smile. It. Duchenne.
Mm-hmm. And that's the type of smiling, a real smile. Not only your mouth turns up at the corners, but your eyes turn up at the corners, right? A real smile. Humans have the ability to tell the difference between that real smile and a fake smile. However, in another little bit of strange human factoids, if you fake smile, your brain takes your fake smile as a signal that you're happy. And because your brain thinks you're happy, in turn, your smile goes from being one that is not entirely real or fake, and it becomes genuine.
It's so weird.
Right? Isn't that strange? It's strange. There's a positive feedback loop between smiling and happiness. And it works the other way too. It's crazy in that if you begin by smiling, you are more happy, even if the smiling started as a fake smile. A fake smile lasts for only a moment before it becomes real.
There's another thing about building habits, which says if you want to like take vitamins and be, if you think that vitamins will make you more healthy, but you need to get into the habit of taking them, for example, if you put them out on your counter, your brain thinks, oh, I'm the kind of person who takes their vitamins. I'm going to mix up vitamins and vitamins.
Yeah.
I'm the kind of person who takes their vitamins because they're here on the counter. So I must be that kind of person. And it then does that thing. So it's not that you decided I'm going to take my vitamins. Just putting them there makes your brain think, oh yeah, I must be that kind of person. So if you tell your brain, I'm the kind of person who smiles, your brain will also say, oh, you must be the kind of person who's happy.
Mm-hmm.
And before anybody says anything, I understand there are mental illnesses, there's depression, there's all sorts of things which affect this. And we are talking about, you know, generally mentally healthy people, not anything more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm. All this chatter between Wendy and I to say, smile more. That is the bluff. Smile more and people will want to work with you. Smile a fake smile if you've got to in the short term. That's fine. Your brain, over time, is going to turn it into a real one. Now, back to what Wendy said at the beginning, guys. You don't need to worry about grinning inanely all day, right? This big smile on your face. If you're not a natural smiler, then you'll not have to worry about smiling all of the time. Like, increase by a small percentage, like by 5%. 5% alone will have a significant impact on the people around you.
Yeah, and remembering to smile if you're not a natural smiler can be hard. So link it with another action that you do frequently. So remind yourself to smile when you shake hands, or smile before you start to speak, or smile when you finish speaking, smile when someone else begins to speak. Maggie and I used to travel to conferences when it was just Mark presenting. And so we would travel to deal with the hotel and anything that the attendees needed and make sure Mark had everything he needed. And one of the rules of manager tours is that as the attendees walk into the conference room, we go to them, we shake their hand, and we introduce ourselves, and we say something like, "We're glad you're here. Here's where breakfast is. Have a seat," and welcome them in. And I hated doing that.
It's not that easy, right? When you do it.
It's not.
It seems hard.
Yeah. But it was weird that after two or three, I did it out of instinct. And I smiled as part of that, you know, like, oh, I'm shaking hands, therefore my smile comes out. And I say these words. And it became natural and not awkward at all in a really fast length of time, like two or three conferences. And all of a sudden I was thinking, well, this is strange. I don't feel as weird as I used to. So you can do this. I believe in you.
Absolutely. Any behavior that is new to you starts off feeling awkward. It's the name of the game. You're a human being. If you do it over and over, though, it goes from being awkward to being you.
Yeah, exactly. It's something you do.
If you are an organization whose response to the last 90 days has increased your managerial compliment, know that we are ready to come to you with our effective manager training. We will spend a full day delivering Trinity guidance for up to 30 of your managers. Each manager will receive an MT annual license featuring roadmap, and your organization will receive enterprise reporting of the learned behaviors, which allows for measurement of your investment in the future. The cost is $17,500 if we come on-site to your location, or $15,000 should you want the training virtually. Contact Maggie at maggie@manager-tools.com to discuss what might work best for your managerial compliment.
So the next one is, say, "Can I help?" There's lots of places where you can say, "Can I help?" But one is if someone is going to be, it looks like they're going to be late or is late with a deadline.
Haha, that's a good one.
Because what us people tend to focus on is there's a deadline and our colleague is about to miss it.
Right.
And so we say things like, "You're late."
Right. Why are you late on this?
"You have to get that data to me by noon tomorrow. Otherwise, I'm going to tell the boss that it was your fault I'm late." Right. And while it is factually true that that person is going to be late, it is not helping your relationship one bit to be telling them.
To point that out for them.
Yeah. They already know. So don't say you're going to be late or you are late or the deadline's tomorrow. You know that, right?
You know that, right?
At best, it comes across as nagging, and at worst, criticism. And people don't appreciate criticism, especially from their peers.
Right, exactly. And also, most of the time when somebody is late with a work product, like they're late creating a report for you or handing something in, it isn't because they don't know when the deadline is. And it's not because they're deliberately knowing that deadline and yet going about ignoring it anyway. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, it's for any number of reasons that's causing them to be late. Now, the reason could be aptitude. Maybe they don't have the skill set to get it done in a more timely fashion. Maybe they don't have all the information that they need in order to create this or do it for you. It could very well be a case of they have too much to do. There's competing priorities. They're struggling to get all of it done and keeping up. And whatever the reason is that they're unable to meet this deadline or that they're struggling to meet this deadline, them at the same time feeling as though they're being criticized for not meeting this deadline does not add value. It's absolutely unhelpful. The deadline being missed still exists as a problem, whether or not they're told the problem exists for them.
Yeah. You reminding them of the deadline will not help them meet the deadline.
That's not helpful. Right.
So instead you say, "Can I help?" So, "Can I help you get the spreadsheet that's due tomorrow finished? Can I help you by splitting the contact list in half with you and calling half the people? Can I help you by doing some of your customer service queries so that you can concentrate? Can I help you by taking notes during the meeting today so that you don't have to? Can I help you by doing the conditional formatting for you? try and think of something specific that you might be able to do to help that person get the thing done on time. Now, if you're working with your colleagues and your team, probably 8 out of 10 times, you have a good idea of what specific piece of help would help them.
Yeah.
And the reason customer service came up is because in Manager Tools, we split the customer. If you write to customer service at manager-tools.com, we split who answers those by topic, more or less. But there's the initial part of when you write in, everybody ends up in one queue, and then we split them. Someone has to go through those and decide who they belong to and split them up. And that can be a long job some days.
Some days.
Some days it's very quiet and there's no work at all. Other days, it can be quite a hard job and it's, you know, we have to do it regularly and all that stuff. So if somebody's got a busy day for some reason, you know, something's happened, it's easy for us to say, hey, don't worry about it. I'll take Reacher, which is what we call that queue. I'll take Reacher and you don't have to think about it. And it's a really nice, if you're busy or if you've got something going on, it's a really nice relief that someone else is going to take care of it. And they'll alert you if there's something that you really need to take care of. And so by offering to help, you get a couple of benefits. First, it reminds the person that there is a deadline approaching. It's a really, if they have forgotten, it's a nice, gentle way to remind them without sounding like you're nagging.
Mm-hmm.
Second, it makes them think, or it gives the impression, even if you don't feel it, that you think of yourself as a team with that person. We are trying to achieve things together, and I'm going to help you achieve what you want to do, which all in return means that they will help you achieve what you want to do in another time. That the principle of, now I can't say this word, reciprocity. Thank you.
Yep.
That word. So there is another thing in human nature is that if I do something for you, you'll do something for me. We like to feel equitable. So, and it tells them this is not just about you trying to achieve your task and I'm over here in isolation. It's about us achieving
We're in this together.
And whether that's me helping you do the actual task or taking something else off your plate or providing air cover with our boss, whatever that is, we're doing this together.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right. So the next one, and I think I found most personally impactful, all of these resonate with me deeply, is taking notes about people's lives. Now, that's one thing about people. People remember important events that are going on for the others around them. Mm-hmm. Right? They start conversations with, for example, oh, how'd the recital go? Or how was Maui? When folks come back from vacation, or how's your mom doing? Is she all right? You might think all these things are irrelevant to work. And if you thought that, you'd be right. They're irrelevant to work, but they're incredibly relevant to relationships. These are the important building blocks of good relationships. And that's what people have that we're wanting to replicate here. Asking people about how they are shows that you're a people. Even if you're not.
And you have to listen to the answer.
Yeah, no, yeah, you don't just ask it to say. You do pay attention.
You have to listen to the answer. So people also remember the names of other people's families. They know their spouse's names, their children's names. They remember how old roughly a child is. If someone's mother-in-law lives with them, they remember that too. It's another part of being a people person that we want to emulate.
Mm-hmm. People also, though, now that we've said all that, People tend to have great memories for these things. People remember individuals and names and important events easily inside their heads. If you're not a people person, you probably don't. So, like any other task that you do, because that's where you excel, you need to get some outside help on this one. That is, take notes. Now, there's plenty of room and plenty of places where you could record this. Just thinking to myself, the notes function within your phone. You can have a page for a person. And within that page, you can write names of spouses, names of children, ages, important events and going-ons in their life right now. On that contact page, you can have that handy. So you can just pull it up and be like, oh, click on Wendy. Oh, okay, there's something. Okay, good. Review it for 10 seconds before you go into an interaction with that person.
In the same way that I have a FedEx number, our account number saved under FedEx, I also have the names of Maggie's children saved under Maggie.
Yeah.
If you're following GTD, you can add ask about Mary's recital to your list for a particular person, just like it was any other task.
Any other task.
Mm-hmm. Alternatively, if you know you're going to see a certain person in a meeting, you can add it to your notes for that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Just make sure wherever you put it, it's somewhere that you'll see it when you're next interacting with that person. You can get away with not asking about something like the first time you see someone, because you can say, oh, I'm so sorry. I saw you on Monday and I completely forgot to ask how your vacation was. But you can't do that like
a month
the
later.
Third time or a month later. It just doesn't have the same effect. So you need to make sure that it's somewhere that, where you'll see it when you see that person.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And using your smarts differently. One reason people get labeled as not being people persons is because they frequently have a desire to prove that they're right. That happens. One of the things that I often talk about in our conferences is some people's gift to the world is pointing out all of the things that everyone around them has ever done wrong. In a meeting, for example.
Yes. My dad and I had a 2-day argument while he was visiting about whether car's suspensions are set up so that if you pass out while you're driving, that the car will drift into the shoulder so that for safety. I claim this is true.
Of course.
My dad claims it is not. And it took 2 days until we would say, okay, I'm done with arguing about it. But both of us are sure we're right.
Are you sure?
We make sure to tell each other.
Right? That's the thing. Like in a meeting, for example, at work, they'll tell somebody else how their idea is not right and it will not work. And here are all the reasons why your idea is incorrect and will not work. And this is seen as others as unnecessary criticism and unconstructive. And regardless of how we personally feel about it, and I know many times our personal feelings is, well, I want to help them understand the situation better, if our want to help them understand comes across as criticism, it is not helpful.
Yeah, people are not interpreting that as helpful at all.
Mm-mm.
So here's the trick. When that happens to you, use your smarts differently. We know you're smart because you're right. So use it. So challenge yourself not to prove that the idea or the solution is wrong, but find a way that it's right. So there is often more than one way to solve a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the choices may be suboptimal in terms of the measures you would use, but maybe optimal in others. So for example, a system error means that your customers were charged for shipping when they shouldn't have been. However, it's difficult to work out which customers were charged in error and which were not. So someone on your team proposes that instead of spending hours working out which customers were affected, the company just reimburses all shipping costs for orders in the period. And clearly, that means that the company will spend more money than necessary on the reimbursements. Some of the customers who are not owed money will get the reimbursement. And for a lot of us, we would point that out.
Right.
That's a rubbish solution because we're going to give money to people who don't need it.
Exactly. Now, we got to remember, though, reimbursing, when not necessary, will get some goodwill, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you weigh that up against the cost of the unnecessary expenses, which we do tend to want to point out, the solution could be right. It's not on its own a false or incorrect solution. There's definitely a potential flaw in that argument. I would completely agree.
You have to weigh in also the time it would take to find that all of those people who are qualified, and we've already said it's difficult to work out which customers should and which customers should have been. So it might take them 2 days. So think about it. You're paying someone for 2 days to find errors, and you're then betting that 2 days of that person's wages is less than the money you would spend doing it by just reimbursing everybody. And when you weigh those things up, that solution of just reimbursing everybody could be right.
It could be. Absolutely. It's not on its own incorrect. Once you've done the analysis, you can then have data to say what is a better approach. But saying rather than, well, that's a bad idea because we're going to be paying people that don't need it. rather saying, you know what, I think Tammy has a point. Finding out these customers will cost us 2 days of labor, and I'll bet some customers will complain during that 2 days. So those customers who get a reimbursement, even when they don't really deserve it, will really like us.
Yeah. So in other words, you've tried to help Tammy. You've still pointed out some of the flaws, but you said, hey, I can see some benefits of this approach and I can support Tammy. I'm going to be a team player and say something nice, as my mother told me. And that isn't to say that any idea that you think is wrong is instantly right. Like, you know, if somebody says the M1 goes to Edinburgh and it doesn't, then
right.
It's a kind of factual thing.
Not true.
It really does. But going through this exercise, think, okay, before I tell someone they're wrong, can I make their answer right? You will find more often than not there is merit to other people's suggestions. So you can be supportive of their ideas in public, out loud, and that will give you something that other people see as a people person.
Mm-hmm. And we told you in the previous cast, that is the part one of this cast, to use the phrase and, not but. That is, once you've congratulated Tammy on her idea, we suggest that you use this formulation to suggest your idea. That is, I think Tammy has a point. Finding out those customers will cost us 2 days of labor, and I'll bet some customers will complain during those 2 days. And those customers who get a reimbursement they really didn't deserve will really, really like us. And I think we could cut down on the number of hours it'll take us to find those people. If we wanted to only reimburse those we should, we can do that as well.
So in other words, you've avoided saying but, which would set your idea up in opposition to Tammy's. Instead, what you're making is another equally valid suggestion. So she has a suggestion and you have a suggestion. And it makes you equal and not making
oppositional.
Superior or oppositional, exactly. And guess what? People who make themselves out to be superior are not the kind of people that
figure.
Other people want to work with. No? Like, if I go around making everyone else feel inferior, guess what? I'm not going to have any friends really quickly.
Exactly.
So this is a really nice way of making suggestions on an equal playing field. There's this one and this one. And, you know, the rest of your team and your boss can decide amongst them. And here's another, which isn't in the show notes, but here's another one. If your boss decides that Tammy's idea is the best one, even if you think it's wrong, don't say so in the meeting. Say, okay, boss, I'll support you on that one. What do you need me to do? Or even, okay, boss, what do you need me to do? Because when you argue with your boss's decisions, particularly in public, that's when your boss starts to feel like you're not part of his team and he doesn't want you on this team. And even when bosses don't fire you, they can make your life really miserable.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
So look up professional subordination. There's a cast for that. But the short of it is, don't say out loud during meetings that your boss is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Just say, how can I help?
How can I help? Exactly. All right. So to wrap it all up, not being a people person, which many of us consider ourselves within that realm, is a hindrance in workplaces where you're working with other people is required for your effectiveness.
That being all of them.
Right? Now, you don't have to change your personality. This isn't about you. Be who you are. This is about your behaviors. Again, behaviors, for as a reminder, the words you say, how you say them, facial expression, body language. This is about what you do, not who you are. You don't have to change who you are. And as you can see, the actions themselves are simple and will have a large effect.
And take it from two people,
right?
people
who know
who've
first
tried these things. They work. And everybody I've ever told or ever suggested do any of those things have always told me they work. So it's not just our experience. I don't know how many people I've told in the 400 years I've worked.
Right.
Since I discovered all this stuff. So, that's it.
Thank you, Wendy.
That's all for this week. We'll be back next week with a new topic.